Now we must remember that the key, as we said it last week again, but I want to keep it before us, the key to the third chapter is this first verse. If then you be risen with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Let your inclination be toward things above and not toward things on the earth, for you have died and your life is hid with Christ in God. But when Christ is manifested, who is our life, then we also shall be manifested with him in glory. The reason I keep referring back to that is that we constantly in this world, Christians constantly make the mistake of trying to extract something from this life, and it just isn't here. This world is full of disillusionments, disappointments, distresses, heartaches, miseries, because that's the kind of world it is. It's like the candy-coated, or let's rather say it's like the worm with a hook in it. Almost everything in this life has a hook in it somewhere. Why? Well, because it's run by Satan. This is Satan's world, and I wish Christians could get it through their head, but they can't. So they're forever putting weight on things of this life, on their families, marriage, love, success, happiness, just one thing after another. And they just keep fighting for it and fighting for it, and it's the big thing of their lives. And yet, there's nothing there. Christ wants us to focus on the things above. Now, that does not mean we shouldn't go do our work here. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be practical, take care of business, and so forth. But it means that we shouldn't set our affection on these things. In other words, we should not expect anything out of this life. Now, that sounds very negative, and I'm always negative about it, because otherwise we get caught up in a fantasy world pursuing happiness and thinking we ought to have it, and even Christians, you see, think that Jesus is supposed to give them happiness. There's one woman who's just furious at me because I have not been able to bring about a happy home for her. She thinks my whole ministry is wasted in their lives because I haven't made a happy home for her. She just failed to understand that that's not what Jesus came to do, to make happy homes for people. And Paul says, he that is married, let him be as though he were not. Not that marriage isn't an important thing, it is, but as sure as we set our hearts on having a happy home, as surely as we do, we're going to lose it. It's just a law of the world. Because Satan finds a weak spot in us, and he'll destroy us through that weak spot. He'll keep reminding us of how terrible it is that we haven't had a happy home. Life is a disillusioning thing at best. And I said a little earlier that Christian people still, in spite of what they know about this world, still try to extract that happiness from it that is just simply not there. Because this is Satan's world, and all the worms have hooks in them, one way or another. The measure of a person's peace is the measure that they are focused on the things of God rather than the things of this earth. A person who's willing to say, well, what does it matter, you know, after all? What difference does it make? And we're only going to be down here for a few years anyway, so what difference? Whether we are successful financially or not, or whether we've got a lot of this world's goods or not, or whether things go our way or not, what difference does it make? And we went into great detail last week, I think, on this, that the thing we're focusing on is not what we're making out of our lives here and now, but what this life here and now is doing to prepare us for the next world, which is the eternal one. We must get into our head somehow that the time passes so swiftly on this earth that it is but a moment. And the older you get, the faster the time goes. And very soon you're over the hill, and then you've got very few years. Like with myself, I know I have a lot fewer years to live yet than I've already lived. I'm well over halfway of what my normal life expectancy is going to be. And it'll be fortunate if I make it. But to that point, you know, if I have 5 years left or 10, it might be surprising, you see, or 2 or 3. So the point is that we're heading toward that inevitable closing curtain. Oh, it's just going to that. Then what difference does it make if things don't go our way on this earth? You have nothing of this world's goods, so what? What difference does it make? You always manage to survive, and if you don't manage to survive, you got a better future anyway. So if you understand that, then it isn't so hard to follow what Paul says. You put away from yourself all these things, wrath, anger, desire, that is being obsession with things of this life, desire for things. Because, of course, this is what keeps everybody bankrupt. They keep always seeing new things they want and they have to have, you know. Things wear out fast and there's always that new thing that we want. We're never satisfied altogether because there's always something else that we need to buy. Then he goes on with people. He speaks of blasphemy, shameful speech out of their mouths, lie not one to another. We think to ourselves, my, that seems to be a little out of place talking to Christians, doesn't it? And I have to remind you that these people that he was talking to were people out of the pagan world, and a lot of these things were habits. There are people who have such a habit of lying that even if they're Christians, they still lie all the time. You might be surprised about some of the people that are Christian people who keep lying all the time. I know some ministers that lie all the time. That's terrible. That's right. But it's true, and some people never get that out of their system. So now that doesn't keep them from being Christians. They may not be very good Christians. I mean, they may be not honorable, but it doesn't. The Bible doesn't say that we won't be saved. Now, there's a difference between a person who has who is a false person, a liar, because he says liars will not inherit the kingdom of heaven. There's a difference between a person who has made a life of lying versus a person who has the remnants of the flesh clinging to him and still tells falsehoods. Just as there's a difference between a person who is a drunkard who has chosen that as a way of life, revelries and feastings, versus the one who is just having a problem trying to control liquor. What Paul is referring to when he, and John and some of these others, when they speak of drunkards, is a kind of person who made his life in the bacchanalian feasts of Rome and Greece, you see, and they were not the person who sits at the kitchen table fighting to keep away from that bottle of whiskey in the cupboard, you know. That's a different kind of a thing. A lot of these things cling to the flesh, and Paul is saying that people have to get rid of those things. He's not telling them they're not Christians because they do this, but he's saying you got to get rid of it. Lie not one to another, seeing you to put off the old man with his deeds, and put on the new man. Now, he doesn't say, he does not imply that putting on the new man has made them new. There are Christian groups that believe that when you have put on the new man, all things have become new, and now you don't do any of these things, and if you do them, it shows you haven't become a Christian. Understand that? You see, the people that think that because, that if you have become a Christian, you are altogether new and you will not be doing these things. And if you are doing these things, it's a sign you're not a Christian. That's not the way Paul puts it. Paul is saying, since you have done this, then you ought to clean up your act. That's a very important point. Because a lot of people get discouraged thinking to themselves, well, if I were only a If I do these things, I must not be saved. And then they go around thinking that they're lost, and that's bad. Lie not one to another, since you have put away the old man with his deeds and have put on the new man, who is renewed in knowledge after the image of the one who created him. Renewed in knowledge. In other words, you know better. You know better. He's not saying you are now God and you're not going to do these things. See the difference? You were created already in the image of God. You are created to bear His image. You're created to understand the meaning of knowledge and truth and all these things. And since that is true, he says, you ought to have enough sense to understand when you're doing wrong. I said to you before, I think in this group, that one of the great problems with the moralists of the world today who are not people of God, that is the socialists, for example, people who are always talking about equality, or perhaps I should say the humanists, are always talking about equality and rights and all these things, and yet they don't believe in God. And I've often said, who do they appeal to then? If you tell me I have to not be prejudiced, I say, who says I have to not be prejudiced? I will be prejudiced if I want to be. Unless you tell me that God says I shouldn't be prejudiced, then you're right. God says that. But if you don't believe in God, don't tell me not to be prejudiced. But it's a lie of Satan that gets people to expect equality and rights and morality and all of that, and yet have no God to look at. Only the person who's created in the image of God and has Him within them is a true judge of morality. So he said, since you have been renewed in knowledge after the image of the one who created Him, where there is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcision nor uncircumcision, barbarian, Scythian, bond or free, but all and in all, but Christ is all and in all. And you see, in God, according to the knowledge of God after whose image we're created, we are all one. There is no difference from person to person, race, skin color, whatever. No difference. All is equality. But that's only in God. Outside of God, everything is different. And we're fools not to accept that. Then he says, put on, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved. Now, this word, splankna, is a Greek word which means bowels of mercy. But in those days, they used various visceral organs to indicate the seat of emotions. Sometimes the liver and the kidneys and whatnot. So what he's really saying is simply put on the sensitivity of mercy. The reason they use those figures is because always when a person has emotional feelings, there's a visceral response. There's a certain sense in which you can say that that's what emotions are, visceral responses. Viscera meaning the organs that have to do with the gut. We talk about feeling something at the gut level. That's what we mean, a visceral response. That's what a lot of love is, a visceral response. It's butterflies in the stomach. So he says here that we ought to put on the sense of mercy, graciousness, lowliness of mind, meekness, long-suffering. Now, lowliness of mind really means a proper evaluation of just who and what we are. And that ought to keep a person pretty lowly. For example, I was talking earlier with one about education. It doesn't matter how much you go to school or how many things you learn, as much as any human brain can contain, it's still nothing compared to the amount of knowledge there is. One person cannot know enough possibly to say he knows anything. No matter how you go, how long? I've gone for 10 years formally of education, getting actual degrees for 10 years. And I don't know anything. The more I know, the less I know, you know. I just feel ignorant. I feel like I'd like to start over again. Because there's so much to know. So it's hard for a person who really has been through it enough to become particularly impressed with a degree. Now, a person who's just gotten their first bachelor's degree or something, they're impressed, you know, and it feels pretty good. But after you've got enough degrees, you don't worry. You don't even think about them anymore. I said once to somebody, I had a master's degree, my diploma, which I got from USC. Do you know I never even opened the envelope to hand it in? I didn't go to the graduation. They sent it through the mail. I didn't even know where it was. Somebody was cleaning out my desk one day, and they found the envelope. It wasn't even opened yet. He said, well, we'll hang that on your study wall. I said, over my dead body. He goes, what? Because why? Because it's zero. It's nothing. It's a little segment of education here that amounts to that much, and who cares? Now, the same thing is true about your understanding of life, of yourself as a person. The more you know about yourself, the less likely you are to be proud about it. That's why it's important to keep confronting yourself. I deal with a lot of people who never confront themselves. It's always the other guy's fault. Forever they're blaming somebody else. It's the wife or the husband or the pastor or the brother or the sister or the milkman or somebody is always at fault but themselves. Anything but themselves. Well, my parents didn't do right by me as a child. Well, tough. Forget it and do what's right yourself now, you know. A lot of people had bad situations in early childhood. The psychologists have given us the leave to hang all our troubles on our parents or our forebears of one kind or another. But true lowliness of mind is the true evaluation of who and what we are. By looking at ourselves, if there are problems in marriage, it's best to not worry too much about what the other person is doing. Just look at ourselves. Not that we're always all to fault, but it's a good thing to do. And that'll keep us lowly enough. If we know enough about our own faults, we're not as likely to be judgmental about somebody else. That keeps us lowly. Then he says meekness, and this word in Greek really means openness to God and man. That is, to be open, meaning that we regard both God and man in terms of reality and truth. We're not closed-minded. Now, that gives us a spirit of meekness, which is what usually that word is translated as, but not meekness in the kind of sense of weakness, but in the sense that we are not so quick to judge, not so quick to make declarations about things and people, not so quick to be one way. We're not one way. We're open about things. Ready to see the other fellow's point of view. Ready to see what God wants. Ready to see the right way of things. Then long-suffering means, in regard to people, that we are sensitive to them and give them a chance. It's so long-suffering is to people what patience is to circumstances. We are patient in circumstances. We are long-suffering with people. Knowing that we are all in the same boat together, knowing we all have the same potentials of wrong and of bad and fault and so forth. Holding up one another and forgiving yourselves. Upholding one another. I've often felt what a tragedy it is that families, for the most part, put each other down. I've rarely seen a family group where they weren't putting each other down. They seem to feel it's their God-given task to keep each other humble. Whereas a home ought to be a place where people support one another and lift one another up. Instead of criticizing and judging and putting people down, we should be upholding one another. Now, that what is true in the family is also true in the church and the body of believers. But Christian people notoriously judge one another and criticize one another and put each other down. Whereas we should be holding one another up, supporting one another, helping one another, and forgiving yourselves. Now, forgiveness is a difficult thing. Someone has said very aptly, to err is human, to forgive is divine. And that is true, because we can accept somebody's apology, but forgiving them is something else. We don't truly forgive apart from Christ, because true forgiveness means that we are able to put it behind it. And that's hard to do. Now, it is one thing to forgive people for things that they might have inadvertently done. In other words, if somebody has hurt us, for example, and they haven't meant to hurt us, if there's some reason to forgive, a human being can forgive. Divine forgiveness is where we forgive when there is no reason to forgive. Where we are justified in not forgiving, and we forgive anyway. That's divine. That's God's kind of forgiveness. Nobody would doubt that it is not, that human beings' conduct is such that there is no reason to forgive, but God has had to forgive us when there was no reason to forgive. He says, if anyone has an occasion, an accusation against another, then we should forgive ourselves. Even as also the Lord forgave you, so also do ye. So, forgiveness is one of those things which only God can grant to us. And our best bet is to open up our hearts to Him and have Him give us some help. If you try to do it yourself, you're not going to make it, because it's just not possible. Above all these things, put on love, which is the bonding together of fulfillment, consummation. Best illustration of that is furniture, for example. Glue is the bond that makes a fulfilled piece of furniture, a consummated piece of furniture that can be used. Glue is the bond. We use a screw here and there, a nail, but for the most part, glue is the bonding together that brings about the fulfilled or consummated piece of furniture. Completeness might be another way to describe that. So glue is the bond that makes a complete piece of furniture, a completed piece of furniture. So love is the bond that makes a consummated or completed body of believers. Love is the glue that holds us together. Now, it is only possible to do that as it is God's love and not ours. God can provide love. In fact, Romans 5:5 says the love of God is poured out in our hearts by His Holy Spirit. God provides the love that glues us together. Now, if we have to see that love as a feeling, we're sunk, because our feelings are not that stable toward each other. But if we see a power deeper within us than our feelings, and we say that God's love is being manifested through us, then we know that no matter how we may feel about things, if we have Christ in our hearts, He's still cementing our relationship together. And we know that the deeds and the attitudes that temporarily may be off base are only a fleshly thing that hasn't destroyed the body. If it depended on our personal feelings, the church would be a shambles today. Still, the body of Christ is held together miraculously by the glue of God's love manifested through us. But don't try to process it. See, if you try to process love in your mind, you're not going to make it. You don't know love. We don't know how to handle or define love. We flounder with it so much. We have misunderstandings of it. But love is something only God understands. So if we have to process it in our brain and then try to act on it, we're going to miss it. But if we just keep ourselves before Christ and relate to people, just relate, just keep open to them. Let God do the loving. You be open. Just say, well, Lord, I can't help how I feel about these people, but I will stay with them. See? I will relate to them. And let the peace of God be the judge in your hearts. The word means to be the judge of a contest. It's the one who finally gives the prize. If you judge your situations by the peace of Christ within you, That means where you are in a situation and there is no peace in it, you probably should get out of that situation. I don't mean you got trouble. I just mean that you're uneasy. If you're socially involved with a crowd of people that leave you uneasy, you better get rid of that crowd. If you're involved in activities that make you uneasy, you better get rid of the activity. Let peace be the final umpire, the referee, the judge of the situation. And the effort to achieve peace perhaps can also be brought in here. In other words, your desire to have the peace of Christ. In other words, your desire to bring about peace in Christ is the best gauge of how to act in a given situation. Whereas you might stir things up and make them worse, you come as the agent of Christ and minister peace. And let the matter of whether there is peace or not be the judge of things. Unto which also you were called in one body. You're called unto Christ. You're called unto peace, unto love. And if you ignore those things, you are ignoring your calling. And be you thankful, he says. Being thankful means being responsive to Christ for what he is to us. It's a wonderful thing to realize that we are really being held together by the power of God and surviving by that means rather than by our own power. For example, let us say that there's a person who's been out on his boat and he capsizes, and he's got 2 or 3 miles to shore. So he sets out to swim, but it's rough, choppy water, and it's a tough job to swim. All right, pretty soon someone comes along, and he says, and he's got a, well, let me take it a little bit of a different tack. Let's say that he's got his raft, he's got his rubber raft, his boat capsized, and he's out in a rubber raft, but he's drifting. He's drifting. Now, someone comes along in a boat and throws you a line. Now he's towing you to shore. Now, where is your thanksgiving going to be? For your own expertise as a navigator? Oh, no, it's going to be for the person who's throwing you the line. He's drawing you to shore. You can be thankful to Christ because he's the one that's supporting you, but the moment you think you're making it on your own, you're in trouble. I hear over and over again from people, oh, we've got so much help out of this book, and here's this guy. Of course, he's not a Christian, but he's got some good ideas and so forth. All these self-help books. Oh, yes, I'm going to be a very positive kind of person now, and I read that book, and now I know I have to treat people this way and that way. All of it's just self-help, and for the most part, without Christ, we'd be foundering. Sure, you got a good boat under you, but it's going to drift. You got a raft under you. But you're drifting without Christ, just going in every direction. So he says, you're called unto peace and unto love, and be thankful that your course is set in this direction, because nothing else is going to be of value to you. Well, I think we'll call it night.